Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, yeah. Today we're going to talk about definitely a book that I love very much, Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. This is episode 164. Yeah, this is one of my favorite books of all time.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, we could have picked this a long time ago probably, but... It's cool that it was picked now, because reading it again was great. It's good timing for me, I think.
Oh, yes?
Yeah, stirred some good stuff up. But yeah.
Had it been a long time since you'd read it?
It has. Gosh, I surely have not read it since we've been doing this. And we've been doing this for, what, 20 years?
Seven. A century, right?
A century, right, right. Since yeah, it's like 7 years almost. Yeah, yeah. So it was before that. Not long before that, I don't think. I usually end up picking it up, and then I start to read the other ones as well. You know, it's ended up, there's probably, I don't know, 13 books in the direct series and the related stuff, some of which are really, really good, some of which are not really good.
Okay.
But Ender's Game, there's just no other book like it, you know, that I don't know. As far as the rest of one of the interesting things, and we don't want to talk about books that aren't Ender's Game, but one of the interesting things that he's done with these is that he's not repeating the same thing over and over. You know, it's like every book is not about battle school, which is what we'll talk about what this is. He's got one book called Ender's Shadow, which is really good. That is the Ender's Game told from Bean's point of view.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really terrific.
Really?
He wrote that years later, and you know, he said that he never intended to write that, you know, but he was like, oh, wait a minute. And then he started a little series of, they're called Shadow books.
Oh, okay.
Because the book is called Ender's Shadow.
Right.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
But
yeah,
anyway.
And,
yeah.
Well, and I know the next one is called Speaker for the Dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I assume, continues Ender's story a little bit.
It does, but it's a totally different kind of a book. So one of the interesting things about the history of Ender's Game is Speaker for the Dead is a book that he sold to Tor.
Okay.
And he was revising it and things, and then he realized that the book made really... It was made even better if Ender was the protagonist in this series. So when he wrote Speaker for the Dead, he wasn't thinking Ender originally, but Ender was the last piece that clicked in and was like, oh my gosh, that's exactly who this is.
So he wrote Speaker for the Dead first?
He wrote Ender's Game, the novelette, first.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so that was published in 1977.
Okay.
And then... He tells a story sometimes about he was at a convention, I believe, some book fair or something like that, and he went to Tom Doherty of Tor.
Wow.
And he said, you know, who had bought Speaker for the Dead? And he said, I've got this thing. This is what makes sense. He said, let's do Ender's Game first, and then Speaker for the Dead as the sequel to Ender's Game. And Tor and the contract was, Tom Doherty said, same terms as Speaker, and he said yes, and they shook hands, and that was the end of it.
Wow.
Yeah, so way back then, you know, it was good stuff. So so he wrote Ender's Game, and then but you know, Ender's Game is something that had been in his head for a long time. The whole idea of the training the military in space, right?
Right.
So, I guess a quick synopsis. Whenever somebody asks me what this book is about, my short version is, it's about a world in which the Earth had been attacked in the past by an alien race, and the search was on for the next great commander, because we won the first war because of somebody brilliant figured out how to win.
Well, they won two wars, right? They came twice, didn't they?
Right, right.
Okay.
And then So that was in the past, and the whole planet is worried, how are we going to win the next one? So right. The search is on to find the next great commander, the next leader. And to do this, what the world has done, and it is worldwide, it's not, you know, so they call it the International Fleet.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so these kids that are on the Battle School, which is an orbital school that kids are brought to, they are from all over the world. So these are the most brilliant people that they can find. And again, we don't want to talk about later books, but there are people all over the world sort of looking for these people. And when they find them, they sort of get drafted. Well, not even sort of. They are drafted. They're not really given a choice. And they're brought to this battle school and basically taught through the use of games and other education how to command armies.
And they're incredibly young. Whose story we follow is six when he's brought there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so he was six when he was first brought there, and he was about nine when they started, putting him in charge of armies and things
in the games,
yeah. Right. So that's what it's about. And the word Ender is, his name is Andrew Wiggin, and Ender for short. And so that's the short version of what the book is about. So the book centers around Ender. Almost the whole thing is from Ender's point of view. Not all of it, but most of it. And so then you get into more details. Well, he's got a brother and a sister, and that's an interesting thing too. He's got an older brother named Peter, who is too violent or too dark.
He lacks compassion.
He lacks compassion. That's perfect. Yep. He lacks compassion. And then Valentine, who has too much compassion, I guess.
Right.
Right. Right. So it's, and then Ender is just right.
And they can see, right, exactly. And they can see there are strict population limits.
There are, yeah.
On the Earth. And so his parents are both religious, and they desperately wanted more children. And something about Peter and Valentine made the authorities say, yes, go ahead and have another child, because, you know, there's a lot of potential that maybe this one will have a different combination of those qualities. So,
yeah,
sure enough.
Yeah. And that's one of the aspects of Ender's character is, even though he's really, really young, he is an outcast by society because he's a third. Mm-hmm. They just call him a third. You know, to have a third child is, I guess, anathema in this society. It's something that you do not do, right? You just do not do it. And there's not a heck of a lot of explanation by Orson Scott Card about what the state of the world is. But, you know, you're just given clues like this. So you assume, what is the world like that everybody's been limited to two kids, against religious belief as well.
Right. Because his mother prays only when she thinks he's asleep.
Mm-hmm.
She'll pray for him.
It's an interesting aspect of it too. So, his dad is a Catholic. His name is John Paul Wiggin. Mm-hmm. And then his mom, whose name I can't remember, and I'm sorry about that, is Mormon. And neither of them do, it's not like they go to church on Sundays or anything like that, because it seems to be suppressed.
Right.
So that they really can't publicly declare their faith in any way. So it's something that's held privately. And that seems to be the norm in this world. And I say world because later on in Battle School, there's a friend of his who says something religious to him, and that's like kind of a profound moment where the person has sort of revealed himself to Ender by saying this, you know?
Right, because he's Muslim or something.
I think he was Jewish.
Is he Jewish? Okay.
I think so, yeah. His name was Ali, A-L-A-I.
Okay, I guess that's why I thought
but I'm
he was
not
Muslim.
Positive, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. But that was my assumption. Yeah. So, So what else to say about this before we can get into spoiler territory? A lot of the book is about the game itself and that was fascinating to me. It was fun. I want to play
it. Well, and the game seemed fun because they had this huge arena type area, or, you know, just a big, I imagine it like a hollowed out ball where they put up a gate and somebody, one set of people is guarding the gate and the other set of people is trying to take the gate. And so you're seeing the games, you're seeing Ender's progress. And then the other component, which I found fascinating, was that they have, I guess it's supposed to be for your spare time, but of course nothing at that school is for your spare time. They had these computer games you could play, or this one main game. And was it called the Mind Game?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And where so, he meets the giant and all that.
Right. Yep. It was like being in a fairy tale land, really. You know, you go and explore this wilderness, but it's like a fairy tale type wilderness. And then you come to a giant. Well, the giant can kill you in the game, of course. Can you beat the giant? What will happen when you do? And so we watch Ender as he will spend his time off playing this game, trying to beat it.
Yeah, and you get the impression that the game is different for every person who plays it. It's sort of a psychological testing slash learning system, so that the computer itself is sort of building the game while you play it.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah, see, I've read it once, which was a month or two ago, and I had resisted reading the book, and Scott knew that, and I think that's why you very kindly never pushed it on me. But it was just because when one of my daughters was young, she in the fourth grade, she was in an accelerated readers program, and the teacher ran out of the books that were appropriate for, you know, a few years older than that age level. And she was letting the kids pick off of a high school list, and they picked Ender's Game. And so I knew it had been written for adults. So I was reading ahead because, you know, fourth grade is really young. And they got to the parts where they were graphically explaining why Peter was not, how he was not compassionate, how he was sadistic. And the examples were such that I didn't feel like a child the age of those kids needed that in their mind. And so since I was only reading it in terms of, was it appropriate for my daughter? And the, some other parent had a similar sort of complaint. So he was also reading ahead for his daughter. The teacher discontinued the book, and Rose, I gave it back to her. We remembered it when she was like a freshman in high school. And I was like, oh, of course. But I was never really interested in finishing it. And I, oh, because Corey Olson at Mythgard Academy, they covered it a while back.
Yeah.
And I, so I was listening to some of the classes and I went,
It's interesting that this is the first book that Corey Olson talked about outside of Tolkien, right?
Yeah.
It was the first. And he's doing a few of them, right?
Oh, yeah. What happens is the Mythgard Academy people who donate money to it, they propose the list and they pick. So he has not chosen any of the books. So they were picking The Lord of the Rings, and then they picked this. This was the first one. So, yeah, so then he's done other books. He's done Dracula. He's done The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin. He's done Watership Down. He's done Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. But in between, they keep putting, you know, various other things, like from Tolkien's other writings that have been brought out by his son, Christopher Tolkien.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. So, yeah. But as I listened to that, I was like, well, I might as well go ahead and read it. And when I read it, I was like, oh, okay. So without having that particular filter of, is it appropriate for this age child? I was able to enjoy it much more and not worry about some of the stuff, sadistic stuff that you see Peter doing. And I realized Peter was not a very big part of the book once you got past that part also.
Sure. Yeah.
Plenty of other seeming sadistic stuff in there.
A little bit. You bet. A little bit.
Yeah. So anyway, so then I read, once I'd read the book and really enjoyed it and I'd made a couple of comments, then you were like, oh, well, then let's do the book.
Yeah. Well, good.
And I would say one of the other things is one of the points of view that you see, which gives a lot of context, very needed context, is that of, is it Colonel Graf?
Yeah.
He is the teacher who's, he's in charge of the battle school, I think, but he's definitely in charge of Ender's training. He takes a very specific interest in him because he sees a great potential.
Yeah, he seems to think that he's the one, right?
Yeah.
He's the one, he's pretty sure. And it does seem to be, you know, that up there, there's advocates for various kids. But yeah, I believe that he is actually in charge of the school. And, but there are people in charge of him too. And so, mm-hmm. you know, at the beginning of these chapters, we have these little dialogues between, you know, they're not always attributed. So we don't always know who's talking to who, but, they're adults. You know, we know that these are adults talking, and they're talking about,
right.
Ender. And really, you know, the utmost manipulation and trying to push him to be what they need him to be. So you have that moral tension where, you know, this is not something you should do to another human being, right? What these adults right. are doing to these kids.
Right.
But it's sort of an ends justifies the means thing in their heads. Which it gives you a lot of pause as a reader. You know, it's a moral dilemma that you can think about, right? Is, you know, yeah. what exactly are we doing here? Is the end justify the means in this book?
Well, because it's made really clear that there is a real threat to the human race. The buggers, which is what they call the aliens, have come twice.
Yeah.
And it was only by sheer, well, you would say luck, but basically an unlikely hero arose that saved everybody by his brilliance the last time. I guess it was the last time.
Yeah.
And they came specifically as an invasion force. So what the people on Earth are worried about is, when are they coming back? We've been advancing all this time. Surely they have also been advancing. So one of the things I like about the book is that, I guess we could talk about
sure.
some of the ending.
Yeah.
Is so at mm-hmm. the end of the book, what you discover is that it was during that second battle that the aliens, who are a lot like maybe a hive of bees or a colony of ants or something, the queen is the one who has the intelligence. The others are workers, and they are telepathically communicating. So to her, when some of these are killed, it's like, as they keep saying, like having your fingernails clipped. They're mm-hmm. not individuals. They're not actually what you would call people. And they didn't ever understand that another race could have intelligence in a different way. So they didn't understand what they were doing. So you get to the end, and it's the end, of course, is what made me go, wow, what an amazing book. Because of course you feel very sad and melancholy over the fact of how they're beaten, which destroys the race essentially. But at the same time, you cannot, it's not left with this soft, squishy ending of, oh no, we were terrible for not trying to talk to them. Who knows? They probably tried to talk to them early on and they just couldn't understand each other.
Yeah. And that's one of the themes of the book really is, you've got, you know, so the macro thing is you have the humans and the buggers, and they can't talk to each other. So they're called like Varels or something. It's mentioned in the book where you have two entities that cannot communicate, and inevitably conflict arises.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're basically looking for resources. And if you don't understand the other, then you can't possibly share.
Right.
It's a strong thing because when you think about that on a personal level, in life, you know, you are in these conflicts all the time between people, and sometimes there's no attempt at understanding.
Yes.
And you ought to, right?
Yeah.
You know, understanding it helps quite a bit. So, but when you don't understand, and then you think about it in the world, in the political scene, where you've got, you know, like nation versus nation, and, you know, the differences between people breeding contempt and mm-hmm. Not discussion, right? Not understanding
right.
and not an attempt to have peace. You know, conflict is inevitable. It occurs. And that's some deeper themes that come out of that book whenever I read it.
Oh, yeah, because even on the levels of Ender versus the two or three bullies that he encounters, he is such, it shows he is a big enough thinker to understand that he has to punish If he can get the advantage, he has to punish the bully enough that everybody sees what happens, so they won't ever come back. He's basically ending the fights he can foresee down the road if he's kind at all to this person. So that's the thing that makes the difference when Graf comes and says, why did you beat that first bully we see so definitively the way you did? And essentially Ender kills him, but Ender doesn't know he killed him.
Right.
Ender wasn't aiming to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Ender was just trying to show everyone how badly he would beat anybody who tried to pick on him so that they wouldn't keep coming back to try to win. And he said, oh, because I wanted to end the previous fights. And he went, okay, that's what we want. We don't want somebody who's just cruel and sadistic like these bullies are shown to be or like Peter was. We want somebody who's, and as they say, they're looking for somebody, and it's a tough blend. Let's see. I know I've got it marked somewhere. Oh, because he says, because basically what stops the war is that a bomb is dropped that destroys all life on the planet.
Mm.
And, but Ender thought it was a game. That's the twist. And I knew the twist because the book is old enough. It came out in the 80s, I guess, as a novel. And I knew the twist is that at the last battle, Ender's not playing a game. He's actually the commander. But Ender doesn't know it. And he says, I didn't want to kill all those people. You tricked me. And he says, of course we tricked you into it. That's the whole point, said Graf. It had to be a trick or you wouldn't have done it. It's the bind we were in. We had to have a commander with so much empathy that he would think like the buggers, understand them, and anticipate them. So much compassion that he could win the love of his underlings and work with them like a perfect machine, as perfect as the buggers. But somebody with that much compassion could never be the killer we needed, could never go into battle willing to win at all costs. If you knew, you couldn't do it. If you were the kind of person who would do it, even if you knew, you could never have understood the buggers well enough. So, and there are the problems with Valentine and Peter.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Peter would never have understood them well enough, and Valentine would never have gone in there and done it.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that final battle, you know, part of the problem, I mean, not only did he eradicate, at least he thought he eradicated a whole species.
Right.
But he also sacrificed one heck of a lot of people in doing it.
And that's the part
he had no idea. So he was confronted with an impossible situation. And, you know, at that moment, it's like, you know, all the things that the teachers did to him and everything is coming up. And he's like, these guys are being unfair. I'm going to be unfair back.
Right.
I'm going to do things that they wouldn't approve of in order to do this because it's the way I can see to win. And he does it. And he's basically sacrificing, he finds out later, just a whole bunch of actual people. And, but he does it and he wins.
And they point out, they said, but they knew what they were doing.
They did,
yeah. They willingly gave themselves for this cause.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because the stakes were high.
Right.
They didn't know.
Yep.
And it's legitimate that if somebody's come after you twice and almost won, you've got to protect the race. I mean, you've got to protect all the people.
Mm.
It's not a wrong thing to have done. Now, I guess the question becomes, was what they did in order to get Ender wrong.
Hmm.
You know, as you say, do the ends justify the means? What does it do to that person? Now, Ender is a very unique person.
Mm-hmm.
But look at all the other people along the way, because they weren't just doing this to the fighters at the end. Look at all the kids.
Yeah, all the kids that were with him, yeah.
Yeah, he killed two people, other people, and the kids who were with him, but also all along the way from the time he's six, how about all the kids from around the world that they're doing this to?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, so do those ends justify the means? Then you start to look at the more of a Spartan mentality.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's a good point.
And what do Christians do in those circumstances? Because you have war as a reality.
That's right. Depending there's such thing as just war.
Yeah.
Right. You know, right. we don't believe in not defending the homeland. You know what I mean?
Right. You're defending the innocent.
Exactly.
And that's what wasn't one of Tolkien's characters in The Lord of the Rings who said, I don't love the fight that's in front of me, but I love what's behind me that I'm protecting.
Right. And that's why
we fight. But what do you do to prepare people for that? And so what I think is really interesting is that this book is part of a, let's see, is it a recommended reading list or the professional reading list for the U.S. Marine Corps at several levels. And I think once you become a corporal, it might be required.
Yeah, and that was interesting to me. You know, I've listened to some Orson Scott Card interviews and things, and he says that when he first conceived of this, he was, his brother was in the military in Vietnam. And he hated officer training school because they tear you down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And he's like, well, what's the point of this? You know, what are you guys doing? Why aren't we building people up? Or, you know, why would anybody come up with this method? So it really put him in the mindset of training. And then he started to think, well, how would people be trained for three-dimensional battle in space? Right. And then the key that opened the lock was these are kids, because you bring kids up here to do that so that all of this newness is not new to them. You know, you bring them off the planet and you come here, and then they are much more willing to accept that, well, like the enemy's gate is down, right?
Mm-hmm,
that you're in three dimensions and you've got to leave behind all of these ideas. You know, it's like when you teach pilots nowadays, you know, in airplanes that are doing dogfighting. Well, they have a thing that they need to break free of. When you're looking for an enemy, you scan in front of you, into the sides and behind you. You're really thinking two-dimensionally.
Mm-hmm.
There could be somebody above you. And they need to be able to think that way. And it could be somebody below you. And that's just in, you know, on earthbound fighting with planes, right? Dogfighting. So that was the key.
We saw that in The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that just cracks me up, doesn't it? It's like, come on, people.
It leads back to the Wrath of Khan.
I'm above you. Yeah. Aha! So, but he was thinking, okay, so we do that. But then he was thinking, okay, well, if it's kids, then they don't have these years of assumption or years of, you know, locked in thought.
Preconceptions,
exactly. And so anyway, that was the key that started. And then he wrote that novelette, which was in Analog in 1977.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it's that idea, because Ender is the only one of the kids who kind of go, he's already predisposed to see other points of view.
Mm-hmm.
So that the gate is down is not a thing. When they're on the ship and Graf's like, okay, where is this? And everybody's aligned themselves a certain way. And Ender's the one who can think in any direction because he's already gone, oh wait, the planet is out there, we're here, this is, he's reoriented. And part of the battle school that I thought was interesting when you compared it to the brief story we get about Peter and Valentine is playing a role is preparing you to live the role. So the kids in the battle school are playing these games. It's preparing them to live the roles of being commanders or soldiers or whatever. But Peter and Valentine, when they're being Locke and Demosthenes and doing their columns and planning their arguments for different positions of world politics, they're preparing themselves to be influential. They're preparing themselves to think outside the box. Mm-hmm. And that gets, you know, Peter becomes world leader because of it.
Yeah.
Valentine becomes very influential both on Ender and on Peter in the end because she's able to think in those ways.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, she basically blackmailed Peter into letting her go.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a really interesting aspect of this too. So not only do we have, you know, we talked a little bit about the religion and how it ends up being oppressed. And it feels to me like we're on that road right now. This book was written in 1985, you know, but it's becoming less and less popular to be a religious person, right? And that just seems like the road we're on. You know, if things continue like this, it may be that, you know, that we're back in our houses and
doing house churches.
Exactly. It's conceivable to me, being where we are and looking down the road, that that could happen.
It's funny because I have, and I can't remember if I've mentioned this here before, but I have a couple friends who are very different from each other and do not know each other at all, who had told me a long time ago that they thought the church would be under persecution in their lifetime. And I was like, you are, of course, crazy. This is America. And now I think about it and go, what's really sad is I could see that, because the way people just shut down religious people who, you know, oh, you're not allowed to make your own choice of whose cake you'll make.
Yeah.
You will go with the greater good as society dictates it. You're not allowed to have your own opinion about this at all.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first started noticing things like that happening, it was really perplexing to me, because I thought that the liberal side of things was like open to everything, right?
Yeah, I know, right?
But then I realized, well, they're not actually. They're the opposite of that. It's like, you know, they're being the oppressors that they think they're defending the world from.
Well, they're not willing to accord people the right to be wrong.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And you find that on the conservative side too.
Agreed. Yeah.
But it's more right now, although it cracks me up when people who are progressive especially will talk about we're going to finally run things. I'm like, you're there. Enjoy. It's happening. Don't you get it? You're not the underdog anymore. That's an attitude from the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, you're being very old fashioned in your thinking. And I would say also Orson Scott Card, being Mormon, would probably always have felt some of that, because, you know, the Mormon religion has not been popular from the time it came up in the U.S. Many people were lynched and killed, and they were driven basically to go to Utah. Mm-hmm. Without arguing about whether the religion is good or bad, that's just the fact. And
true, yep.
Even in me growing up, you kind of knew, you know, with my atheist household where we didn't really think about religion, but you kind of knew something was a little off about the Mormons with the history of the multiple wives and whatever the other, you know, things are that just don't jibe with what we think of as regular religion, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. So he would have probably always have a little of that feeling that you and I now have.
I agree with that 100%. Yeah, there's always, you know, having grown up in this culture, you know, for people that don't know, I live in northern Utah, which is got to be the most LDS area of the world.
Right.
You know, I live north of Mormon Rome, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, so but having lived, yeah, there is this this persecution aspect to it, sort of a defiance. Mm-hmm. That is always present. So you're absolutely right. They definitely are all cognizant of that. They're taught that. Nobody forgets that at all. In fact, it's a big deal. We just had Pioneer Day. It's the 24th of July, and that's a holiday in Utah. And what they're celebrating is the trek across the country that these pioneers took. From Missouri, which is where they were persecuted so badly.
Yeah, and Illinois too, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, so, right. So, but they, yeah, it's part of their culture. They're part of their culture. And in fact, a lot of their kids, they call them young women's and young men's groups. A lot of them go on sort of simulated treks, I guess I would call it. I call it a trek because, yeah, so you would go out for a week or something like that, and out in the wilderness and with hand carts and things, and sort of,
oh, really?
Yeah, go out camp for a week and with a group and walk your hand cart across the country, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah, a lot of people do that.
Well, and, you know, and of course it makes me think about, as Catholics, the Catholic faith was in the same circumstance when this country was being settled and founded, but even before there were states. You know, Maryland was Maryland, mm-hmm. but then you had Pennsylvania, where, of course, the Quakers were not much perceived much better. But Catholics have been persecuted, not to, of course, the degree of, you know, martyrdom in a lot of cases, but they were often second-class citizens, considered by a lot of the people that they lived around for a really long time. I mean, to the point when a lot of people forget when JFK was running and everybody kept going, I don't know, he's Catholic.
Yeah, yeah.
Pope's going to tell him what to do. And the way he got around that was by going, well, I'm an American first and a Catholic second. And I'm like, thank you for starting that slide downhill. Because that's the open embrace of secularism, that you have to balance all that with your faith. But how do I say it? Faith has to come first. The way you express yourself in the secular world has to be a reflection of the truth that you know and believe. And if you're Catholic, that has to come from the teachings of the church.
Yeah, that's a struggle. I mean, that's a struggle for me personally, because it's like, okay, we live in here in the United States of America, and though I definitely believe that faith needs to inform your political decisions, meaning you shouldn't be doing things that are against your faith,
mm-hmm.
right? At the same time, how could a Catholic ever be president if they're not, you know what I'm saying? If you're not saying, okay, I am an American citizen, and in this job, I need to be an American citizen. I need to be making decisions that are in the best interest of all of the United States. And not in, and sometimes that may not be a compromise, may not be in the best interest of you as a Catholic. You know what I'm saying?
But I'm thinking, so then in that case, what you're saying is that, again, speculative, everybody.
Sure.
But living as a Catholic isn't good for America. And I don't think that's true.
Well, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. I believe that living as a Catholic is good. And if everybody was doing it, I think that that would be excellent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's what we've been given, right? Mm-hmm. I honestly believe that. But at the same time, there are compromises that need to be made in reality, where we have things that occur, and you're not going to be able to get ideal, right? You may not be able to outlaw something that you want to outlaw because you think it's good for everybody. Therefore, you have to compromise, and the compromise, in the act of compromising, you may have to make a decision that is against your Catholic faith, but is a step in the right direction.
Well, and I think that's how we live our lives now, right?
Yeah, agreed.
It's how we... It's also how a president has to do it anytime. You're right. Because even if, okay, so you're a faithful Catholic and therefore abortion is a sin, what that means is that you're just going to throw your support behind everything you can to try to stop that. But you, like God, like Jesus, have to also accord people their free will.
Right, exactly.
And he did it so much that he died on the cross for that. So if you're a Catholic president, I can see you being a Catholic president, because for one thing, the Pope doesn't come and tell any of us what to do. So that was, you know, just a silly prejudice that was, you know, like, in fact, I recently, about a month ago, had an argument with somebody about papal infallibility. And they're like, and these were relatives even. And it's like, if you... If the Pope says, you know, you have to have your birthday cake blue, then he's infallible, and so you have to do it. I was like, no, no, it's under special circumstances. It's only matters of dogma or doctrine. It's all, you know, so these prejudices go on. But I would say you can be Catholic and be president if you're going to be a faithful Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
How do the saints do it? They sacrifice themselves. But they don't force people to do it. You don't want a theocracy, because that's not according free will anything either.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
It's like the IF is a theocracy. They don't have religion, but their religion is doing anything they can, sacrificing anything they must to beat the buggers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't really looked at it that way.
I just kind of came to me talking about all this stuff.
Yeah, that's something else.
Because that's true. You know, it's fascinating to me, and this is the thing that will eventually make me reread the book, I guess. I hadn't really ever thought I would. I mean, not that I didn't like it, but the way Orson Scott Card weaves all these themes in and around from the very beginning. You know, the idea of religion, the idea of leadership, the idea of when do the ends justify the means. I mean, even the idea that, you know, what we find is Ender wins the battle, the ultimate battle. But all three of those Wiccan kids are necessary to save the world.
Agreed. Yeah.
He's unconscious, but Peter and Valentine's machinations behind the scenes are required to solve the war on Earth that's been building up behind the scenes and bring more peace.
Right, right. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. It's sort of, you know, Peter... it's really interesting, Peter Valentine and Ender, how that whole dynamic worked. It's like all of these things, it sort of speaks to human suffering and results of suffering a little bit, because, you know, Ender is persecuted by Peter.
Yeah.
But yet Peter and Valentine helped create what Ender needed to be. Ender couldn't be Ender without Peter and Valentine.
Right. And so Valentine needed to be toughened up so she could take the necessary stand to be the check to Peter.
Yeah.
And without her love for Ender and her hatred of Peter, because everybody hated Peter because he was awful, she wouldn't have been who she was either. And so that kind of goes back to your question of, can a Catholic be president? Because your question really is, how do you function within the areas with where you do have power, which is our lives in the secular world.
Yeah.
Even our lives in the religious world. I mean, there's no group of Catholics getting together working on a project who all think the same and who want to do things the same or even have the same goals.
Yeah, agreed.
So how do you balance the individual, which is, you know, you individually and your faith and how you practice it with the group? Whether the group is the church, because there are places where you can disagree with the church, and that's fine. The church isn't a, you know, doesn't have a stranglehold on you, even though it looks like that to a lot of the outside world. How do you function within your groups of close friends? How do you function within the bigger world? And this book is amazing because it addresses all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. That's got me looking at the book in a different light, too. I hadn't really thought of that aspect of it, but you're right, it does.
Well, because Valentine and Ender, don't they have a conversation about being a tool?
They do,
yeah. And the goal is not, you know, and they're like, and Ender especially is like, I don't want to be a tool.
Yeah, that's when Ender has basically had it. He's completed battle school, and he's like, I don't know that I want to do anything else anymore. And
I've checked out.
And she's basically saying, at this point, you know, you need to do what you're here for, right? Which is what God asks us to do, right?
Right.
You know, it's the parable of the talents and all that. It's like, you, if this is what you need to do, you need to get on with it. But yeah, it was during that conversation, what you're talking about. They were on a lake. Yep.
She says, because they know Peter's a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And he always, when he's playing the game or when he's having dreams about the game, which are also very interesting, when he's most full of self-loathing is when he sees Peter's face instead of his own in a reflection.
Yeah.
And so Peter is the monster, but yet he still craves Peter's approval in some way, because at one point he says, you know, Valentine sacrifice to be with me instead of the brother she really loves or something, Peter. Yeah. I can't remember. But anyway, Valentine basically says, you know, essentially, how do you not be Peter? She says, stop being such a selfish little bastard. Save me. You know, to get him to go back.
Right, right.
And that made me, this whole book, and this is the comment I think that made us think about talking about the book, is when I was reading this whole book, halfway through, I started thinking, you know, within different bounds, but this is like watching God work with people who become saints.
Yeah.
They don't have easy lives. They don't. I mean, some do. But everybody's got to do stuff they don't want to do, but stuff for which they are uniquely suited. And God is not like Graph. But in a way, he is. He knows what you have to go through to live out your full potential. But you have to cooperate. If Ender isn't cooperating, if Ender just gives up and goes to the raft so that Valentine has to be sent for, Graf can't make him do anything.
Hmm.
And Graf at the end, when Ender's unconscious after the battles and everything, you know, he hears the voices and he goes, I know, I love him too. And that's Graf's voice. Graf loves him.
Right.
But Graf had to put him through that for the bigger purpose and also to fulfill his ultimate potential.
Absolutely so, right.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well put. I completely agree. Yeah. All that stuff and everything that he went through, it was something.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And when Ender's successful is when he thinks he's not doing when he goes, oh, I'll show them. I'll cheat. I'll play the way I'm not supposed to and I'll win and they'll finally leave me alone. Well, that's what they've been trying for the whole time. Pushing to that extra level of thinking that he didn't know was in him.
Right. Just do whatever you can come up with.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Right. And so that's kind of the same thing is the way the saints surprise us, of course, is by their total surrender. You know, each one has different skills. Some people are out there inspiring others in faith. Some people, I mean, you know, like preaching, turning people back into Christians. Like I'm thinking of St. Francis de Sales when heresy was running rampant and he's like, I think I can help. And they went, okay, here you go. And within a few years, everybody's got a solid faith again. And sometimes you have Mother Teresa who does stuff that no one can understand at first. She's picking dying people out of the gutter.
Yeah, yeah.
And letting them die a dignified life.
Yep, yep. It's excellent. Yeah, as far as Catholicism goes, Speaker for the Dead takes place on a Catholic world.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a world called Lusitania, which I think is the original name of Brazil. If I recall, but they speak Portuguese and it's sort of a Catholic thing going on. They go to mass and stuff. And then in Ender's Shadow, you remember Bean?
Mm-hmm.
Bean is found by a nun. A nun is, you know, they're in a poor city and I think it was in Poland. And the nun is who finds him and presents him to battle school.
Oh, right. I forgot. That's his story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So Ender's Shadow is Bean's story, right?
Right. I remember you saying that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But interesting. Yeah. That's interesting to me. So.
Well, and it's funny because I remember there was a blogger a long time ago who I don't think this blog exists anymore. And it was called Mormon to Catholic. And this person was blogging when they were in the process of investigating Catholicism. And this is before Facebook and everything. So you could have much deeper conversations. I miss that about blogging sometimes. There are not as many comments. And a lot of times the conversations just are only surface deep. But it was really interesting reading about it because I think that's where I read them saying that really if Mormons leave the LDS community or the church, the place they almost always go is Catholicism because they believe it's been a big truth. You know, they absolutely believe it. Well, if they start to doubt that truth, they're looking for someone who can show them not a similar truth, but like a structure. Mm. And also we have the truth. And Protestantism tends, I think, to be a lot more scattered, you know, which
yeah.
one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that could be, you know, because Mormonism is really structured, you know.
Right.
It's like, you know, one of the most appealing things to me about Catholicism is this concept of mystery,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. Because it fits what's real. It's like, you know, how could we possibly understand what God is or the nature of God,
right.
you know, we simply can't. So there's gotta be this concept of there's something mysterious out there that we're not going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, that really isn't in Mormonism. right? In Mormonism, everything is set. You know, God used to be a person. You know, how exactly he became God is, I guess that might be mysterious, but it's like, you know, what the afterlife kind of looks like is sort of talked about. And, you know, there's different levels of heaven and, you know, it's all completely worked out, you know? Mm-hmm. So you're, for them to then realize, well, there's something more than this, you know, I think it's natural. The mysticism of Catholicism is something that's missing in Mormonism. And I'm not Mormon. So, I mean, I'm saying this from observation of living in a very LDS culture for like 20 years. So I have had lots and lots and lots of conversations from people that are what I would call honest and earnest believers to people who have fallen away and just say, there's nothing for me there. So I've talked to a lot of them, but anyway, so that's where that comes from. Just so, you know, there may be a Mormon out there who wants to take issue with that. And I'm perfectly willing to talk to anybody. But I just wanted to say that that's kind of where that comes from.
Well, and that's also, I want to mention that that's something that I also tend to kind of forget about the Catholic Church, because from the outside world, it looks like the Catholic Church has just got everything locked down. And I know this, I absolutely know this, but I forget to bring it up, is what you said. There is the aspect of mystery. The church, one of the things, really, the only thing the church is there for is to help us all get to heaven. And so what it does is try to go, okay, so here are the truths, and here's what they're based on, and here's the tradition, capital T, meaning it comes from the beginning, and here's lowercase tradition. These are all the practices and things that may help each of you try to get closer. Because we can't define these, we can't say how it happens. Each person has to have their own personal faith journey, if you want to use that terminology, but within this larger structure, because these are the ways we do know. There are a lot of ways to get from Dallas to Cincinnati. Do you want the highway? Do you want these blue highways? Do you want a combination of these things? We've got all these things spread out for you to try. We can't say what you're going to find on the way, but here's your ultimate goal.
Yeah.
You know, and here's some things we know. You have to go to Cincinnati, like the Eucharist.
Right.
It's real.
Yep.
It's God. It's Jesus's, body, blood, soul, divinity. And so that's a mystery. How much of that you understand, how much of it you want to understand, you can meditate on it your whole life. We're not going to argue with that. But here's this truth. Cincinnati is here. Here's the Eucharist. You want to try to get there.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Right.
So I forget that. And that's what I love about, well, and I was going to say, so maybe that's why Orson Scott Card kind of was interested in Catholicism for those aspects that you were talking about.
Well, I think that those aspects too, and also, you know, LDS people serve missions, and he served his mission in Brazil. I don't know how much the process of when you go on a mission, you know, you go to this missionary training stuff, you know, usually it's languages and things, but I don't know how much of religion that they're taught, meaning, you know, you're about to meet a bunch of Catholics. Here's what Catholics believe. I don't know how much of that actually takes place.
Oh, okay.
It's more of for those that are open, we want to present this in this way. Kind of a training.
Right.
Yeah. They call them talks. So if you have missionaries come to your door, they have these set things that they're going to go through. If you're interested and you allow them to, they'll start these missionary talks. And,
oh, okay.
You know, I can't remember how many of them there are, but that's, you know, how they start doing that. But yeah, fascinating religion. You know, and the thing is, I know so many people. There's so many excellent people in the Mormon religion. I know so many of them, but I do disagree. I can't help but to disagree, but I really like them. I've been treated very well. So I'm happy to know them. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And in that way, we're called on to be like Ender, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has the empathy. he tells Valentine the most terrible thing is that he loves his enemy. He understands his enemy and he loves them. Not meaning emotional, but he knows them so well. And then he crushes them because he has to know them that well in order to be able to crush them.
Yeah. And, right? And not only that, we haven't talked yet about what happens after the end. Right.
Yes,
so, right. so these heavy things, you know, happen when it's over. So, mm-hmm. so he destroys this home planet, but it doesn't stop there. It continues for a little while after it should mm-hmm. have stopped. Right. It's like that could have been the end of the book right there. But
right.
instead, Card goes on because Ender can't go home. Right. It's like, well, for one thing, the reason that he can't go home is because Peter is the hegemon, which is the leader of the world. Right.
He's running the world.
He's running finally. The world. And he's like, I would love for Ender to run my army. And if he can't run my army, I'm going to have to make sure he doesn't run anybody else's. Right. So Valentine basically said, I am going to reveal all this horrendous crap about you to the world unless you let me go. And I'm going to take Ender with me. Mm-hmm. And by go, meaning I'm going to go to a colonized planet. Mm-hmm. Somewhere off world. And so in Ender's Game, the there's this thing called an Ansible in which you can talk instantly.
Yeah.
Communication takes place instantly, but travel does not. So if they travel to another planet, there is this relativistic effect where, you know, it may take them 50 years to get to another planet as far as the Earth is concerned. So as soon as they left the solar system, Peter was going to finish his life. Mm-hmm. You know, he was going to be old by the time they got where they wanted to get.
Right.
So,
but they were going to still be like, you know, 20 or whatever. Right,
exactly. Or, yeah. So for their time, it may take a year. For Earth time, it may take 50 years. Right. But yet they can still talk, right? Which is a very interesting aspect mm-hmm. of it. But one of the things that I really like about this, you know, is Ender becomes what is called Speaker for the Dead. He practically invents a religion. But before we get there, he discovers that there's a bugger that's alive, right?
Well, because basically what they've done is they've colonized the bugger's homeworld and right. various other worlds that yes. they had. Mm-hmm. And so he becomes the governor, mm-hmm. but as the colony grows, he is less needed as a governor than maybe as like a Lord Justice sort of a thing, kind of giving the ultimate answer in matters of conflict. So he has more time, and his great interest is to find out and communicate to people everything he can about what the buggers were like.
Yeah.
That's his main goal. And so he finally has enough time for all that. And yeah, so then he's out exploring and he finds, he's like, wait, this looks familiar. And I like that he has somebody who's what, 11 years old with him, Abra.
Yeah, yeah.
And it takes Abra to recognize, oh, it looks like if a giant skeleton had been grown over, and Ender goes, that's why this is familiar.
From the game,
he's going through mirrors the mind game that we had watched him work his way through. So we also understand the significance of it. But time has gone by, so it's kind of overgrown. But even when it got to the part about, I reread the end of this before uh-huh. we talked. And when it got to the part where, you know, they didn't have mirrors, because it becomes clear the buggers had read his mind and read his dreams. He'd been having nightmares and it had the buggers in it. So they had been reading his mind. And it gets to the part where it's like a mirror. It's a shiny thing that they've drawn a human face in it as best they can because they didn't do art. So this is what he would have seen in the mirror. And rereading that the second time, I started crying.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was just, you know, they're trying as hard as they can. He asked two or three times when he understood more of what was going on, not all. He's like, so have we tried to communicate with them? And they're like, don't start feeling sorry for them.
Right, right.
They're monsters. They came after us twice. They've had plenty of time. Well, of course, through this, you see how hard it is for them to try to do anything. So anyway, as he goes on, he comes across a larvae, and that larvae is a new queen who's ready to have the eggs that will become the new bugger race. But she's able to communicate with him mentally.
Right.
With the old queen's thoughts.
Absolutely. And then after that, after communicating, he writes basically a book about the buggers. I think it was called The Hive.
The
Hive Queen, that's it. Yeah, The Hive Queen.
Yeah.
So he writes a book and he signs it Speaker for the Dead. He doesn't sign it Ender Wiggin. He signs it Speaker for the Dead. So then this religion sort of pops up around it. I say religion, but what it is that at a funeral, you can have a speaker for the dead speak for the dead person. And right. what the idea is that, you know, everything that the dead person needed to say, this person would say at the funeral. And
hiding no faults, hiding and pretending nothing. No virtues.
Exactly, exactly. And then the next thing that happens is Peter, so that he starts to communicate with Peter, right? So Peter is old and is at the end of his life, but they can talk via Ansible. And then when Peter passes away, he writes The Hegemon and signs it also Speaker for the Dead. So he writes a book about Peter.
Well, yeah, because Valentine has been writing the history of the wars.
Yeah.
It's a 7-volume history. And the Speaker for the Dead volume had been just very quietly published. No one said who it was by, and it was passed around, and that's when the Speaker for the Dead kind of slash religion starts up. And then Valentine's books, her last books published, and she put at the very end Ender's book.
Yeah.
And that's when Peter contacts her and he goes, I know who wrote it. If he can speak for the buggers, surely he can speak for me.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting because it says, so they talked, and it says, with Peter pouring out the story of his days and years, his crimes and his kindnesses. So he did commit crimes, and he did want Ender to be his face so that people thought better of him. But there were evidently kindnesses also, which I thought was interesting. And so then Ender writes a second volume signed by the Speaker for the Dead. And that was the one that was called The Hegemon.
Right.
And they were holy writ.
And they were holy writ, it says. Yep. That's something.
Yeah. And then he takes the cocoon or the larva or whatever, and he goes looking for the world where the buggers can be. Because one of the things, and I mentioned this earlier, is, you know, they didn't realize until that second war that these were individuals who each thought the way a queen did. And they're like, oh my gosh. And so they're filled with guilt. And she says, we are like you, the thought pressed into his mind. We did not mean to murder, and when we understood, we never came again. We thought we were the only thinking beings in the universe until we met you, but never did we dream that thought could arise from the lonely animals who cannot dream each other's dreams. How were we to know? We could live with you in peace. Believe us. Believe us. Believe us. And that's... And one of the great things about that is, of course, she's very sad. Of course, they've done everything they can to speak to the person who has the most empathy and compassion, hoping he'll find that place that leaves their future in his hands. But also, she feels regret but not anger when the bomb is coming and she knows they're going to all die. She knows what they did, and they're sorry. And if this is how they have to pay because we couldn't understand them, the people couldn't understand them, they're willing to accept that judgment. That's a very open, sacrificial, vulnerable, saint-like way to look at it.
Yeah. Sure is.
Yeah. You know, we want things to be different. We're sorry for what we didn't know what we were doing, but we accept the consequences because we did it.
Yeah.
And it's the way Ender, it's exactly a mirror of who Ender is. He also has that regret.
That's
he didn't
right.
want to kill them. He didn't know what he was doing either.
Yeah.
And so what you see by the end is, you know, this reflects the part of the dream, which I loved so much, where he kisses the snake instead of fighting it or killing it or whatever. That signifies his full humanity.
Right.
He goes through and everyone's cheering him, and it says he doesn't notice that they all wore Peter's face. He just knows he's with Valentine, who he loves most of anyone in the world. And so what Card does that's so brilliant is, in that way that you were kind of mentioning, he leaves the mystery. There are solid answers for us. But what he shows us is that what we think is so solid is not always, you know, written in stone. Because Graf says we're the Wicked Witch. In the Fairyland mind game, the children are the wolves. At the end, the buggers are the ones invaded, and they're very human, not the humans. So he's never, and the reason this all works is because he's never going, we're horrible and they're amazing, which is very much the progressive mindset. And he's not saying we were fully justified, which would be very much the super conservative mindset. He's taking that position in the middle. There's a certain amount of mystery, and we have to feel our way the whole time, but we have to try to understand who each other is. Maybe that's how you be a Catholic president.
Maybe so. Yeah. Maybe so, exactly. Yeah.
It is an amazing book, and there's that nostalgia and sadness at the end, but it's also full of hope for the future.
Yeah, I agree too. Yeah. And that's where we leave Ender, is he's got the Hive Queen with him, and looking for a place where he can, you know, let them sort of reestablish, right? And that's where Speaker for the Dead starts.
Right. I assumed that because of the name of the book. But
yeah, and Speaker for the Dead is completely different. It's not even, it's amazing. You know, this book, Ender's Game, won the Hugo and the Nebula Award that year. And then Speaker for the Dead the next year won them both as well. But really? They're completely different. It's like,
Do you like it?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I do. In fact, a lot of people would argue that Speaker for the Dead is better. But it's completely a different kind of book. It's like if you have, you know, like a teenager that absolutely loved Ender's Game, sometimes you give them Speaker for the Dead and they're like, not sure what that was. You know, it's more of an adult book. You know, if people love Ender's Game, I would give him Ender's Shadow, because that's a really interesting what he did there. And then there are the shadow novels after that are also interesting. So what the shadow novels are, what happened to all the Battle School kids? So the Ender's story kind of moves way forward in time, right?
Right.
Because of, you know, as soon as he went to that colony, again, Peter's old and everything. So you've got that timeline, but back on Earth, what's going on? Well, all these kids that were Ender's Geesh, you know, they are all in really high demand by countries in the world, you know?
Yeah. Cause they're all allowed to go back. He has to stay on Eros. Exactly.
So they're all like, yeah, please command my army, 12-year-old kid, you know? So, and the world kind of disintegrates into, war. You know, everybody jockeying. Yeah, now that the buggers are gone, let's get back to what we were doing. You know, which is an unfortunate but very possible situation.
We
forget so quickly.
And one of the things that's very effective about the story also that we really didn't touch on much, I don't know if it needs much touching on, but is you've been working toward this goal. Well, what happens afterward? You know.
Yeah.
In this book, all we see is the various kids are sent back to Earth gradually, but Ender can't come back. So he's left alone and kind of just drifting in his life. There's nothing for him. And so this also raises, I imagine, what Orson Scott Card would have seen and heard from his brother, which is, you know, what happens to you after you fought that war and you come back? We see this all the time.
We see this trauma all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. You have, how do I adjust to the real world again? And what do I go on and make of my life? I've been working toward this goal. Well, now I'm not needed in that capacity. Who am I?
Yeah. And that's one of the things, you know, we see out of Ender is, you know, when he's puttering around the asteroid.
Yeah.
And he's like, here, teach me how to fix this thing.
Right.
You know, because he's like, well, the skills that I have are no longer of use to me. So I need to learn something else. And, that's a good attitude.
Yeah.
But you're right. It happens, you know, in successes and failures, period. You know, whenever you're not only war, but, you know, there are times when you put a lot into achieving a goal. And then when the goal is achieved, you look around and you see that there's just more work to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not everything that you hoped, perhaps, you know, because there's nothing but God that can fill that.
Right.
But the thing is, you you know, what do you do now? And what's the next thing? And then sort of regathering yourself to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're right. It is an emptiness, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I tend to think of it as like letting a field lie fallow so that it can regather its strength and just kind of rest and the nutrition or the nutrients come back to the soil.
Mm.
But if you're, like you say, if you've been working towards that goal and then you're like, well, but what am I good for? And that's kind of what's always come to me is, you know, it's okay to rest too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But gradually we're not made to just sit around and rest. It's what Valentine says to Ender on the raft.
Mm.
We're not made for this. Now she's bringing up the human versus the tiger. We're made to fight. And I don't think that's necessarily true either. But you do have to have something that you do with your life. You're a certain person. You fit into the tapestry in whatever way.
Yeah.
But you have to find it.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So much truth in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just everywhere, you know, everywhere we look. So
yeah, it is really an interesting book and has, I don't know... I don't know how he can hit these themes in other ways, and he must, because these are some of the basic themes of life, really.
Yeah, I think that his strength as a writer is, you know, having read a lot of his books, not all, but it is this moral dilemma that he sets up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that he would take from Ender's Game, and you can see in other novels where you have... a good person faced with terrible choices. And I think if I was going to say that there's a theme of all of his stuff, there's some, you know, that would be the overriding thing.
And I would say that also he himself has a clear moral center. It's not that he's telling you that moral center.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings, because he's got his own worldview. That's going to be reflected in any way that he's presenting all these dilemmas.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's just that there is a truth. There is a way we have to live. There is a way that you treat other people that's good and that you treat other people that's evil. What do you do with that?
Right.
And some of the modern things you read, it's harder. Well, for instance, last time we were talking about silence and saying it seemed a bit squishy. And I feel like that's because there was maybe a lack of that underneath everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, could be. But yeah, I agree with you on Card.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
All right. Well, thank you very much for reading it. That was fun.
Yeah, it's a great choice. And
fun book.
Yeah, and once again, we started off going, well, I'm not sure exactly what we'll talk about. And so the places this led us were kind of like the mind game. They were a bit surprising.
They were, yeah. That was fun.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun. All right. Well, my goodness. So what do we have next? Something light. It is something light.
Quite the same mood as the other stuff.
I love it.
Deliberately chosen.
Excellent.
Tootsie.
That's it. Yep. Fun. I'm eager to see it again. It's been a long, long time.
It has been a long time for me, too. Although, surprisingly, it's my oldest daughter's one of her favorite movies. And so I was talking to my youngest daughter, who's living with us now, saying, I'm going to watch this again. Are you interested? And she goes, no, Hannah watched it so much. I kind of feel like I have it memorized. So I'm like, that's so funny because they were at an age where I wasn't watching it. So
yeah,
I feel like it's been decades.
How fun. Well, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well,
all
good.
Right.
Well, thank you very much again.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
Yeah. And thanks everybody for listening.
Yes. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.